Get a deeper connection with the Cougars of BYU Sports.
God gives us a gift, and we use that gift until he takes it away.
Deep Blue.
Just sitting down afterward and being really tired and thinking like, wow, I just won the U.S. championship.
This is Deep Blue. Here's your host, Jason Shepherd.
Thanks for tuning in for a new episode of Deep Blue. This is the show where we get to know the person behind the number that you see on the field or the court. These are the true stories of BYU athletes from their own mouths. And my guest today is BYU alum and UFC fighter Weston Wilson. Weston, thanks for taking a few minutes. It's nice to meet you. How are you?
I'm good. It is good to meet you, and I'm happy to be on the show, Jason.
So now we mentioned that the number that you see on the field or the court, you don't necessarily have a number. Usually you're not even wearing a shirt, so I don't know how we're going to come up with the number. If you had a number, what would it be?
It's a weight class. my number is 145, 145 pounds.
There you go.
There you go.
I like that. That's a good answer. I want to start out with this, and I'm fascinated by this. Mike Tyson once said, he says, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth, and I'll add kicked in the mouth because of what you do as well. Someone who's actually been in the ring and experienced this, how accurate is that?
It's pretty accurate, especially like when you're just starting out and you're like a beginner, you get in that panic mode and you're like, oh, what just happened? Like, where am I at? I remember my very first fight was in Utah. I was actually still at BYU. It was August 2012. I was fighting this kid, Skylar Frazier. This kid was just ripped, you know, tattoos and an 8-pack and everything else. And I'm just this tall, skinny kid. I didn't have like any muscle, like my muscles weren't like fully developed yet. And he hit me, and I remember thinking like, oh man, I could go down any second. I was like, or I can just throw a punch back. And so I just threw a punch back, and I saw his mouthpiece fly out of his mouth, and I was like, oh. And all of a sudden it woke me back up, and I was like back in the fight. But I remember thinking like this wasn't going as planned, because he just came out guns blazing, hitting me as hard as he can. And like, it was probably to this day like the hardest I've been hit. And yeah, I wasn't ready for it. And then as soon as I hit him back, like, it all cleared. And I was like, all right, let's get back to the game plan. But it, 100%, like, now I can get hit and I can, like, regain my composure. There's several things. I work with a sports psychologist. So there's, like, several things and anchor points that I have that help me reset and to gain focus again. But it's definitely a true statement in the beginning of your journey into martial arts.
Well, I know in talking with like football players, even, you know, it doesn't matter what side of the ball that they're on. It's like you're not really into the game until you get hit. Like that kind of wakes you up and then like sort of almost settles you down a little bit once you get hit. Is that kind of the same type of thing for you?
Yeah, I think a lot of fighters are that way, where you're kind of slow and sluggish and then you get hit and it kind of wakes you up and your body goes into that, you know, fight or flight response. And for a fighter, it's always going to be that fight response. And so, yeah, I would say it does take like getting hit, or I have other teammates who like, they have like a very long, extensive warm-up process where they're like basically draining the tank. And then they go out into the cage and like, okay, I'm ready to fight now, after they're like a sweaty mess. And they'll do like a full on fight before the fight. Me, I'm more like, I'm going to sleep and I'm going to like rest. I'll hit pads for like 2-3 minutes and be like, okay, I'm good. And then, yeah, I'm somebody, I'm like, I got to get hit or me get like a takedown or get a good shot before I like wake up in the fight.
Right. Your last fight was against Jekicerigi, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's, and you won this that
weekend,
fight
actually. Yep.
Yeah, you won that fight. So what do you remember most about that fight specifically?
So that was, you know, that was my third fight at UFC. My first two fights, I fought two guys that were, you know, they're in the top 20. Jekka was the first fight where it wasn't short notice. And I had a full, I think, 8 to 9 weeks to train for that fight and prepare. So we did a couple of things differently. Like I have a sports psychologist that I work with, and we broke down like the nerves and how to control the emotions and how to like just be present in the moment. And so that really helped me quite a bit. And I remember walking out, and it was the first time, because both of our, all my fights so far have been in the UFC Apex, and they don't, at the time they weren't letting family and friends in. This fight was like one of the first fights that they're like, hey, we're going to allow you to bring four family members in. So I got to have my wife, my mom, my dad, and my brother. And so I remember like in the cage looking at them and like having this calm and like happiness over me. And so that fight, like it went exactly to game plan. It, everything that I said I was going to do, like I did, and even like when he came in and punched me and bum rushed me, like I was able to keep my composure and be like, okay, we're going to get to the wrestling. We're going to get him taken down to the ground. It doesn't matter if it's top or bottom. Like I'll be able to finish him with whatever submission. And so, yeah, it was one of those times when the 8 to 9 weeks lead up and everything we were drilling and game planning, like went perfect.
You've brought up a sports psychologist a couple of times already. And this kind of been a theme in talking with athletes over the last, you know, couple of years, is that side of sports in general, regardless of what the sport is, that has become more and more prominent, just how important the mental side is beyond anything you can do on the physical side. How much do you believe that has helped you to get to where you are, just the mental side of things and working on that as much as you do the physical stuff?
So for me, like I was never like a very confident person, and I was always like very insecure, and I was always like the B team type of guy. And so I've always like questioned my ability and doubted myself. And I realized that like, that's what held me back for so long, was just that lack of self-belief and learning how to control the nerves, learning how to control all the emotions that come with, you know, any sport performance. And so learning like these tools of like how to let a thought go, or just let a thought be a thought, like it doesn't mean it's real. That helped me a lot. And then having like these anchor points of like, okay, when you're feeling this emotion, like this is your anchor point, or this is, so we have a couple phrases that my coach uses to like help me snap out of it. Like if he sees I get hit really hard, he'll give me a certain phrase. My phrase, it's kind of stupid, but it has a deeper meaning. So let's say turn on the gas. Gas is my daughter's initials, Georgia Adeline Scarlett. So it lets me know like, okay, I'm doing this for my kids. And so that flips the switch in my mind, like, okay, I'm not panicked anymore. Like I'm thinking about my kids. I'm good. You know? So we've developed like little phrases and things that he'll shout and I'll hear it and I'll be like, okay, I'm good. Like there's, you know, nothing matters. Like really the grand scheme of things. And from a gospel standpoint, like my family is the most important aspect, you know, the gospel is the most important aspect. Everything I'm doing in the cage, it doesn't matter. Like at the end of the day, like none of it really matters. And so that helps me put that perspective, and we sometimes put more pressure on ourselves than we need to.
Yeah. That's fantastic. And you talk about perspective, you know, how do you balance everything? Because there's obviously the demands. I mean, it's your job. And so, you know, there's a financial aspect to it. So you got to train and you got to participate in the fights, and you've got to do all these things that take up time and energy, but yet you're a husband, you're a father, you're a businessman, you know, you've got all these balls that you're juggling in the air. How do you balance it all?
You know, I've been blessed with like an innate ability for time management. So back when I first started fighting, I was working a full-time job. I was a full-time student. I was newly married. And I was fighting full-time as well. So like I learned how to like just structure my day in a way that I can, you know, put one hat on, take one hat off, and just like transition. So at BYU, actually, my day was, this is going to be really crazy. So I would wake up at 8:30. I would get on my bike. I would bike to the gym. I would train from 9. I think our practice was like 9:30 to 11:30. Then I would bike from the gym to my classes. I would bike home. I'd see my wife for about 3 hours. And then I worked from 7 p.m. to 3 a.m. And then I'd bike home, go to sleep, and then do it all over again.
Rinse and repeat.
So I was sleeping. I was only sleeping like 4 or 5 hours a day. Now I get a full 8 hours of sleep. My job allows me to work fairly flexible. And so I have my training sessions and I work, and then I have my, I work in the morning, go train, and then I finish my day, and then I spend time with my wife and kids. Then I go train again at night. And then, after training, usually my wife and I, that's where like we get to hang out and, you know, chat about the day and things like that. So it's just setting up systems and schedules, structure, having a structure, and that's helped me kind of manage. And then I just make sure that in transition, like if I'm driving home from the gym and I'm going to come home and be a father, like make sure I take off the fighter hat and put on the father hat, and vice versa. Like when I'm going from training to working, you know, learning how to just flip the switch.
What was your introduction to fighting? Did it started kind of with wrestling, right?
Yeah. So I was wrestling since seventh grade. And then we moved to Brazil, what would have been my senior year, and I couldn't wrestle anymore. And so my dad was like, look, I know you're like into this whole MMA thing. And this was 2005, 2004 that I like was into MMA. So it was like super counterculture.
Yeah.
And honestly, like it just even like the support from the church has been crazy. Cause in the beginning it was like, whoa, what are you doing? Like, you shouldn't be doing this. This is not what members do. And then now everyone's like, oh, okay, it's cool. Like, you know, there's actually two members of the church in the UFC, me and one other guy. And so like, it's, and we always joke. I'm like, I used to get questioned all the time about my worthiness and this and that. And now it's like completely supported. I've spoken to the youth several times. I've done firesides. I've done, self-defense seminars for the young women, the Relief Society. Sometimes the young men will ask me to come in and do like a grappling class. And so like just the perception of what the sport actually is has been phenomenal. And like just seeing like, oh, this is actually a support, like a real sport. And it's not like just, as people would coin it, human cockfighting, you know? And so it's been really cool to see that change over the years.
So you were saying that you guys moved to Brazil. So did things kind of ramp up while you were in Brazil? I mean, so take me through that part of it.
Yeah. So we moved to Brazil. I like got held back. So I had to repeat my junior year. And there wasn't like a ton of Americans. I was at an American school, but it was like a culture shock. And so for me to like really fall in love with like Brazil and the culture and the people, like it was MMA. And so that's where I learned Portuguese. Like I wasn't learning Portuguese in school. I was learning it in the gym. They would like yell at me in Portuguese and I'd have to like piece what they were saying to me. So I learned a lot of slang. My Portuguese is mostly slang, but, so that was where like that replaced wrestling for me. And I fell in love with jiu-jitsu. I fell in love with boxing and kickboxing and, you know, the whole sport of MMA. I'd go and I would compete. I didn't get to compete. Like in high school, I didn't get to compete in MMA, like as a whole sport. Instead, my coaches would, okay, I'm going to have you do a kickboxing match. I'm going to have you do a boxing match. I'm going to have you do a jiu-jitsu match. And so I would have to do each individual sport. And it was like, I'm grateful for it now. Like back then I was like, no, I just want to do MMA. I just want to mix it all together. Like I want to use my wrestling. I want to like do everything like all in one. But like, I'm grateful now because I got to like slow roll it and understand the differences of each martial art. And I remember it's funny because I was American. The Brazilians at the time, they did not like American, not, they didn't hate Americans, but like in sports, they were never going to let an American win. And I was in a Muay Thai tournament and they call me to the ring. And so I go to the ring, and I know they called me. They called me to ring number two. It was a big tournament. There's like three rings. And I go to ring number two, and I'm looking across the ring at this kid. He's like 6'5", 200 pounds. I'm 150 pounds, 6'1". And I'm like, oh my gosh, like we're in the same weight class. Beat the tar out of me. And this is my very first time doing any sort of like punching, striking sport. And I'm just getting he's kicking me in the head. He's punching me in the face. 90 seconds pass. And I'm like dazed and confused and like, oh, stop, stop, stop. And I was like, oh, did I get knocked out? Like, what's going on? And the ref was like, oh, sorry, we called you the wrong ring. You're actually in that ring and you've got 1 minute to make it to that ring. Otherwise, we're going to disqualify you from the tournament for failure to show up. My coaches were so mad. They're like, no, you called us that ring. You guys are lying. Like everything else. We went out. And we talked about like getting hit and warming up. So I was already warmed up. This kid wasn't. So I was ready to go. I was just like, all right, I've already like taken 90 seconds of a butt whooping. And so I went in there. I knocked that kid out in like 30 seconds. I make it to the next round. And then they disqualified me. That was 2005, 2006 Brazil. Like there was no way that some young American kid's going to win a Brazilian national Muay Thai tournament.
Hey, what a great story. Look, maybe you need that warm-up fight before the fight. Maybe that's the key for everything.
I remember like talking to my coaches. I'm like, is this what it's like? Like, I'm going to get my butt whooped. Like, this guy's huge. They're like, no, that's your opponent. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, he's like my size. Like, I can handle that.
Yeah. Well, look, and you've said before that you were never the biggest, you were never the strongest, the most athletic, but you were the hardest worker. Where did the work ethic come from? Where do you think the drive for you came from?
I think my mom, I remember growing up as a kid, my mom would, she was always working. And she was a very goal-oriented person. And I remember we had just moved from California to Arkansas. She had my baby brother. So I was like maybe 9 years old. And my mom, you know, it was the first move. It was her first time moving outside of California. And so she was kind of going through some mental struggles. And so in order to get over that mental struggle, she's like, I'm going to set a goal to run a marathon. And I'm going to run a marathon. And so I remember she would take care of us kids. She'd wake up early in the morning, go on a run, take care of us kids during the day. And then she'd put us to bed. And I remember she'd leave the house and she'd go on a run. And so just seeing that as a young kid, I saw her work ethic. And it wasn't like my mom was like a talented athlete or anything else. And so for me, I was like, okay, you know, I just have to work and just always work. And as long as I don't stop working, even if somebody's more talented than me, eventually I can catch up. Eventually I'll get to where I need to go. And you know, I've been doing MMA for 20 years. It's a young man's sport. I'm 36. I didn't get signed to UFC until 34. I was one of the oldest signees that year that I got signed. There's only one other guy who he was like 35 who got signed. But yeah, I was one of the oldest guys to get signed. And yeah, were there kids that were better than me? 100%. But I didn't quit and I just kept outworking them. And I'm in the UFC and they're not anymore. Or not, you know, they didn't make it because they gave up. And so I really think like life is all about attrition. And if you can just win that war of attrition, you can go a lot farther than you think. You just can't quit. You just have to keep, you know, one day at a time, one foot at a time, just keep stepping forward.
You already mentioned a few moments ago how you kind of had to deal with people questioning whether or not, you know, a member of the church could still be an MMA fighter and how those two seem to be at odds. I'm curious, and I know you served a mission, so we're going to get to that in a second, but I'm real curious to know if there have been opportunities for you in the sport to be able to share the gospel or share your testimony. I mean, because you know that what a unique opportunity you have in a sport and in an arena that doesn't have a lot of of LDS representation, you have a real opportunity to be able to share your testimony that could affect a lot of people. Have you had those chances?
I've had a few. I think just my presence, people know, like, I don't drink, I don't smoke, and it's very much like MMA is very much like a, it's not so much anymore, but 10 years ago, it was like very much like a frat,
right?
Like a frat scene where it's like, okay, well, we're going to fight and we're going to go party and then we're going to, you know, go train. So I would never like participate in any of that. I wouldn't go. And so that people would always question like, well, why aren't you doing that? Why aren't you like having fun? And you know, all that. And I'm like, well, I am having fun. I'm just not going to do like what your definition of fun is. But I also had a coach in Utah who wasn't active at the time. And as we go on as we go on trips, you know, for different fights, we'd get a talk and he'd see the way I live my life. And we get to like, you know, I'd get to share my testimony. It was cool to see him kind of reconvert into the gospel and become active again. Out here in South Carolina, like everybody knows my standards and they know like the things, you know, that represent me. I also teach the youth in Sunday school. And so like, there'll be times where I'll either be in the corner of somebody fighting and we'll drive like me and Coach T will drive like 4 or 5 hours to get back so that I can be there for church to go teach on Sunday. And so I think it's just living your life as an example, not necessarily like preaching, but my way of preaching is just doing it the way that Christ did, is where I'm just an example. Like I'm, and if you have questions, I'll answer your questions and things like that. And oftentimes if you live your life in that way, people are going to ask why, you know, and then that's when I feel like it opens up the opportunities.
When did you talked about coming back to the United States. At what point in your life did you guys leave Brazil and come back to the States?
So I left Brazil straight on my mission, and then I returned home.
So you went on your mission from Brazil?
Yeah, yeah. I was technically a foreign missionary serving in the States.
and you were called to the Western New York mission, correct?
Yep. So I was in Rochester, New York, Palmyra. I was what I called myself a site elder. I spent most of my mission actually in Palmyra or in Geneva, Fayette, New York, and it was fun. It was such a blast. And it was funny, it was the only state in America at the time that MMA was illegal. So I served my mission in the only state where there was no MMA. There was nothing there. Like that temptation was completely gone because they weren't doing like fights. I couldn't like, I would never be able to go and watch a fight or anything.
Yeah. The Lord took all temptation off the table for you and just said, you know what, you focus on your mission, young man.
Yep. Yep. No, 100% was that way. And, it was awesome. Like, honestly, that really, I feel like set me up and taught me like how to deal with emotional and mental anguish and that sort of fatigue. Cause missionary work, you're not getting tired from like physical work. It's the emotional, like helping people and, you know, really empathizing with their struggles and seeing it and trying to help them through that. And so that's where I feel like you really like learn how to exhaust yourself. And as you exhaust yourself, then you're going to be able to take on more and more. And so I feel like for me, I was, especially in Western New York, where everybody knows a church and you know, you hear every, I'd knock on doors and people like, oh, we know Joseph Smith and you know, this and that. And they just say all the craziest things. For me, it was like, once again, at the year mark, I spent the whole last year of my mission in Geneva, New York. So I was in only one area for a whole year and, everybody knew me. And I got to the point where I was like, there's knocking on doors is not going to be effective. And I was like, and I was reading, about like Christ on earth it dawned on me, like, I'm doing missionary work way wrong. Like knocking on doors and just trying to convert people that way isn't going to be effective in this area. And so I told my companion, I was like, look, we're not going to knock on doors the rest of the time I'm in this town. I'm not going to knock on a door. Instead, I'm going to go to the churches, the other churches, and I'm going to ask them how we can help. And so I started going to other churches and I'd be like, hey, how can we help you? Like, what can we do? And we would spend our day walking, picking up trash, or we'd see somebody like, oh, we need to change your tire. All right, we'll change your tire for you. Like in our shirts and ties. And I went through so many like shirts, they would get dirty or ripped or whatever. Cause all I did was surf. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to serve people. And that's how we're going to tie yourself out. And that's, I always knew like I was able to work hard and that my body was like built to carry like heavy yokes. So that my whole last year, and I went from an area that hadn't had a baptism in like 2 years to baptizing every month, at that time. And
wow,
we made really great relationships with the Catholic Church, in Geneva, and we would do stuff and we had, and like the whole ward started like doing joint stuff with the Catholic Church. It was pretty awesome. And yeah, I was like, I'm not going to do traditional missionary work. I'm just going to serve people and I'm going to use my body for good.
Well, after serving the Lord in Western New York for 2 years, what was next for Weston Wilson? Well, we'll find out after this. We'll take a quick break. This is the Deep Blue Podcast on BYU Radio. Hi, everybody. Jason Shepherd here, host of the Deep Blue Podcast. I want to make sure that you're aware of all of the other great podcasts we have on BYU Radio, like Her Why, hosted by Lauren McLean. It's all BYU women's athletics all the time. These great athletes join Lauren to share their personal stories of triumphs and trials, and we've got some of the best women's athletic teams in the NCAA. This is their story. This is their why. Listen to it wherever you get podcasts. Welcome back to the Deep Blue Podcast here on BYU Radio. I'm your host, Jason Shepherd. My guest, Weston Wilson, UFC fighter, joining me here. And before the break, we're talking about your mission. So was it always in the cards for you to go on a mission, or is that something you decided later as you got older? What was the situation behind that?
So I really had a hard time. I was living in Brazil. I really wanted to be a fighter. Like that was what I wanted to be. I told everybody growing up, like since the sixth grade on, I was like, I'm going to be a fighter. Like I wasn't, back when I was a kid, wrestling, fake wrestling was like the big thing. And I told everyone, I was like, no, I'm into this real fighting. Like I'm not into the fake stuff. And so I told everybody from like a young age that I was going to fight in the UFC. And, so I was 19, I was really big into fighting. I was living in Brazil. All my coaches in Brazil, like, yeah, you can make it. You'll make it to the big show one day. And, I didn't want to serve a mission, but the stigma at the time was like, you've got to serve a mission. And so I really was questioning whether or not to serve a mission or just commit and put all my eggs in the MMA basket. And I remember I was on my family, like my aunts and uncles, they came down to visit, and I was 19, I think, at the time. And, trying to figure out like if I'm going to go to the military, if I'm going to fight, like whatever. At that point in your life, you're trying to figure out your life and you're praying all the time. You're fasting. You're trying to figure it out. And I was on this bus trip taking my aunt and uncle and my cousins down to Foz do Iguaçu, like the big waterfalls down in South America. And I don't know why my dad like just told us to take a bus down there. It was like a 6-hour bus ride. And there's this little like Amazon pygmy guy, and he kept asking us questions, and he was asking us about our church and everything. And I remember at that moment, I was like, okay, I got to go on a mission. Like it just dawned on me. I have to go on a mission. I went, I remember saying to everybody too, like when I put in my papers, like, where do you want to go? I was like, anywhere that's not cold. I was like, I don't care if it's foreign. I don't really want to learn a new language. I was like, anywhere that's not cold. I got sent to Western New York, Spanish speaking. It was cold and I had to learn a new language. But it was good. Like it was what I needed. And it, like I said, it set up the rest of my life. And, I think as you listen to Heavenly Father. It might not be the path that you think you're going to go for yourself, but it's the path that Heavenly Father needs you to go. And as long as you're willing, He'll make it up tenfold.
Speaking of setting up the rest of your life, after your mission is done, did you immediately roll in BYU? I mean, did you have a pretty concrete plan as far as what you knew you wanted to do, or were you still just kind of feeling it out?
At that point, I was like, okay, I need to go to BYU. So I was already accepted before my mission to go to BYU. And so I went, but I didn't get right back into MMA. I didn't actually get back into MMA until after I got married.
Which in terms of timeline, how long of a gap was that?
It was 4 years. So 2 years of my mission and then 2 years post-mission. Actually, the first semester I got into BYU, I did try to fight. I went and I was training for like a month and my grades tanked because I didn't know how to manage everything. And so my mom was like, hey, I know you want to do this whole fighting thing, but no girls want to date a fighter. Like, you know, the stigma in the church is still very, like, at the time, like, nobody, you know, is going to support you. Nobody's going to date you, yada, yada, yada. So she really pushed me to not. So and at the time I was like, okay, the timing's not right. Like, I didn't feel like it definitely, like, the Lord took that desire away from me, if you will. Like, I didn't feel the need to fight. And then I got married and I was talking to my wife and I was like, you know what? Like, I really, really desperately want to at least do it once. Like, I've competed in kickboxing, I competed in wrestling, I competed in jiu-jitsu, I've competed in boxing. I was like, I really want to do one MMA fight and just see where it goes. And so I was like, okay, yeah, let's do it once, see where it goes. And so I fought that kid. He was undefeated. He's 3-0. He was ripped. And if you look at like the picture of the two of us in the cage, like one of us looks like a fighter. One of us did not look like a fighter. And I ended up beating him. I submitted him in the second round. And after that, I was hooked. I was like, okay, I'm going to keep going. And I had ups and downs and losses and wins. And my mom was really big and like, hey, you can't make this your full-time thing. You have to get a career. You have to like graduate school. You have to, you have to like have a way to support your family, because if you just put all your eggs in the fighting basket, it's not going to be pretty. And so advice to you kids, listen to your mom. She knows a thing or two. And so I did. I was like, okay, you know, I graduated. I made sure that I took care of my family. And I feel like I've really been blessed for listening to my mom in that regard, because my wife and kids have never, you know, gone without. I've always been able to provide and take care of them. And like at the same time, I'm still able to like accomplish my boyhood dreams and goals and aspirations. It's been awesome. Like, I don't know. I think I've really been blessed in that regard, because I've listened to my parents and, you know, I didn't fight them on it and, you know, acted like I knew more. We had hiccups and we definitely had arguments, and there's times when my mom was like, I don't think you should be fighting. Like, you should quit fighting. She's now since come around, and my mom's probably one of my biggest, well, my dad's been my biggest supporter, but my mom is right there up with him. And, it was awesome getting to fight in the UFC in front of them. And, I remember after I won, my last fight, I was like the huge underdog. I wasn't supposed to win. I was supposed to get knocked out. This kid was supposed to be like the best out of Southeast Asia. And, getting to see like the reaction of my wife and my mom crying and they're just like overcome with so much joy. Like, it's a memory that I'll like will never fade out of my mind.
From the time then that you start to get back into fighting to the time that you sign with UFC, how much time are we talking about there?
2012.
Because there's a lot that, So I'm sorry,
2012 to 2023. So it was almost to the day. It was almost 11 years, or it was 11 years.
So you're talking about over a decade of grinding and working as hard as you can for this goal. What went into keeping you doing this every day? Because you have no idea when that break is going to come. So you're just going along with faith that it's going to work out for you. What was that journey like? We'll get to the story on signing with UFC, but the journey to get to that point, what sort of lasting impression has that made on you, and not just you, but your family?
Yeah, the journey itself, like there was definitely times where I was like, man, am I going to make it? Like, what am I doing? But I think like I always put my faith in the Lord and his plan. And I've always put my faith, and I'm not saying like I had this, you know, confirmation that I would make it to UFC or anything like that. But there's definitely moments where like living the gospel and also fighting have like melded together for me. I'd actually like, I've written several things about like gospel lessons learned in the cage, because there's so many things that have like strengthened my testimony through fighting. But, you know, there was like just not fighting against the Lord on where I needed to be. And I would find like, as I went to where I was supposed to be, it opened opportunities for fighting as well as my career and everything else. So, I think like there's certain moments, like when I left Utah and went to Dallas, like that was a big moment. And then that opened the door for me fighting in Bellator. That also opened the door, like where LDS Living and all these other church, you know, publications and stuff, like got recognition of, you know, fighting on a national level. And then, so I won that fight and then I lost my next fight. And then we moved to California and I won a couple of fights and I lost a couple of fights. And so, the opportunity to move out to South Carolina and train where I'm currently at, opened up and that was where things really turned around for me. And COVID actually turned around for me. So I moved out to South Carolina and I started training with Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, who actually has a huge Utah following. He fought in Utah last year. And so he was in the UFC, fought for the belt and, so talking with him and talking with Coach T, who's like a second dad to me now, you know, he was like, look, you're great. You're a great fighter. Like you just have to believe in it yourself. Cause at the time I was 7-5, UFC's not touching a guy who's 37-5. And so we came up with a plan. We're like, look, we're going to fight every month, whatever weight class we can, and we're just going to beat whoever stands in our way. And so I went on this miraculous run where I went like 10-2 and, all of a sudden I started getting, you know, notices and calls, but I think it was really just like believing in myself, believing that the Lord is going to, you know, provide for me whatever happens and, you know, and trusting in my coaches as well. And so, yeah, I think it's just, there's a lot of ups and there's a lot of downs. But it's just like sticking with it, like not quitting. And I always told my wife, I was like, look, I'll be done at 35. I got signed at 34 and then I'm like, all right, we're just going to keep playing with the house's money. Now we're signed to the UFC. Like, let's just keep seeing how far we can take it. But I also like, I always promised my wife and kids, I said, as soon as I get signed to the UFC, I said, oh, we'll go on this epic vacation and we'll go and, we'll do something that, you know, like I'll pay you guys back essentially. Like I'll pay for all the time and sacrifice that my wife and kids have made for me to go and fight and train and everything. I was like, I'll pay it back. And so I did get to honor that in February of last year. We all went to Hawaii and we took an epic vacation and I spent like a whole fight purse on
the It's not cheap.
No, it was not cheap. But it was great. Like I got to pay it forward to him. So
let's go back to the story when you mentioned signing with UFC and, you know, as you mentioned before, you know, it was later than you would have liked. But you've got a pretty cool story on how that actually happened. And it all came because of a prompting, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the state president asked me if I would come in and travel down to do a self-defense seminar at girls camp. So like, all right, yeah, no problem. And so I'm driving like 3 hours because this girls camp was like 3 hours away. And I'm like a big gas station food-aholic. So yeah, I'm driving and I stop at this gas station. I bought like a Red Bull and I had bought a couple slices of pizza and I'm driving and I just had this prompting like, hey, you got to throw all that out. Like you need to start losing weight now. And I weigh 175 pounds. I have to cut to 145 pounds. And so I go, I was like, all right, I threw it away. I stopped at the gas station. I got water instead. I drove down. I did the self-defense seminar, and I actually had to fly out from Atlanta to corner a teammate. And while I'm in the airport, my manager calls me and he says, hey, it's between you and one other guy. They really want to sign the other guy though. He fights on Friday. So this was Thursday. And he fights on Friday. Depending on how that result goes, they're gonna figure out whether or not they're gonna sign you. So he's like, so start cutting weight. And so I was like, okay. So I flew out to Houston. I'm cutting weight the whole time. My teammate is cutting weight. We're like 10 days from the fight. And then Friday night, that kid wins. And so I'm like, oh. So I call my manager. I'm like, hey, you know, what's the deal? Like he won. Like, yeah, they're gonna sign him. They're gonna sign this other kid. And I was like, okay. And then I was like, all right, you know what? I'm going to keep cutting weight though. Like I'm not going to stop until I know it's 100% official. And so like, that was the problem. Like, just keep cutting weight. And so I fly my teammate, he wins this fight. I fly back home. A couple of days have passed and I'm like, hey, did they make a decision? He's like, no, it's nothing yet. And then like, it's now Tuesday and I had to go into work, into the office cause I'm remote usually, but I had to go into the office and, all of a sudden my phone starts blowing up and I have all these reporters like, hey, we heard you got signed to the UFC. Like, what do you think? And I'm like, I have no clue of anything. Like, I don't know what's going on. So I'm like on the phone with my manager. He's like, as of like 3 a.m. last night, you weren't signed. Like they weren't going to sign you. And then, like the opponent's manager, like hit me up. He's like, hey, you know, we're fighting you and everything else. So then I call my manager again. I'm like, hey, here's all these messages I'm getting. And then he's like, all right, let me call the UFC. And he's like, oh, you're officially signed to the UFC. And so I told my boss, I was like, hey, I'm not staying to work today. Like there's too much going on. And so like I was, and the worst part was my wife and kids were out of town. My parents were out of town. So I'm home alone. Like I don't have any of my support system. And so like, I was like, all right, I'm gonna go and celebrate. And so I bought like a whole new outfit for the UFC, like fight week. And then I'm home alone and I just start having panic attacks. I'm like, what is going on? And like, I start reading all this negative media about me and everything else. And like, I'm like having severe panic attacks. I have nobody. And this is why, like, I love Stephen Thompson and Coach T, which is Stephen's dad. I call them like in panic attacks and they're like, it's fine. Like, you're good. Like, you just by yourself. So I called my wife. I was like, hey, you got to get home. Like, I know you're with your family. She was out in Oklahoma with her family. I was like, you got to get home. Like, I need somebody here with me. Like, I'm having like severe anxiety. And that was like where I was like, I need to get a sports psychologist. And the UFC actually provided one for me. And he's awesome. But yeah, like that was a story. Yeah, having my support system, like they helped me get over it, and I went in. It was a close, like I had a close opportunity to finish the fight, and then eventually got finished. But you know, it was 20 years in the making. You know, it was something that I'd worked for 20 years, primarily on. I mean, with the 4 year break between mission and first 2 years of school, but yeah, like outside of that, like I've been grinding for 16 years consecutively.
What is the, I don't know, the strongest feeling in that moment when that has been a dream and you finally have an opportunity to live that dream? Is it gratification? Is it relief? Is it gratefulness? Maybe it's all of it all wrapped into one. What is the sense of emotions that you go through when you finally reach that point of your career that you've been striving for all along?
I mean, it is all of that, but in different phases. Like at first, like it was excitement and like, oh man, we finally made it. Like, this is awesome. And now it's time to like show the world what you can do and everything else. And then there's like that validation of like, you did it. Like you said you would do it. Like there's a validation, like the doubt, like leaves your mind. And then, you know, you got gratitude for like all of your loved ones and everybody who supported you. And like when, for my debut, like I opened it up to all my siblings. I was like, hey, you guys can all come to Vegas. Like I'll pay for your room. I'll pay for all of your food. You just got to pay for the travel out there. And so like I opened it up and so the majority of my siblings actually came out for the debut. And like it was, so there's like the gratitude, and then all of a sudden the panic started coming in of like, can I perform in front of everybody? Like, am I gonna be like, what happens if this, like you're going through like the worst case scenario and you start to catastrophize the whole situation as well. And then after the whole experience, I was like, even after like the loss and everything, like I got to that point where I'm like, well, what's next? You know? And so then you're like, you worked so hard for one thing, and then it was like, okay, what's next? Like I'm happy and I'm content, and I'm like, the world could end tomorrow and I'd be happy, but then like it starts to be like, okay, what's the next thing? And so that's where you had to like find new goals you have to start climbing new mountains and things like that. And so yeah, so now I've got new goals that I'm setting and pushing for myself, and hopefully I'll get my second or my next fight. I'll get my next fight and have a second win in the UFC very soon. I don't have anything set at the moment, but we're hoping to hear something soon.
What is, you talk about goals, what is the next thing for you, do you believe? What are those goals that you're still trying to achieve? What's kind of the next phase for you right now?
So I'm on the last fight of my contract. So I need to win that in order to get a new contract. And so I would say just right now, there's no grand big goal. It's just winning the next fight and not just winning, but I want to win in a spectacular fashion. Like I want to get like the performance bonus. So that is probably like the next like little goal. But eventually I want to work my way into the top 15 and really prove to myself that, you know, you are one of the top 15 in the world at what you're doing.
For someone that is going through a similar process like you, that they, whatever the dream is, whatever the goal is, what would you say to someone who's at the beginning of their journey but can see what they want the end to be? What type of advice would you give them for their own personal journey?
I would say there's going to be ups, there's going to be downs, but just stay the course. Like, That's probably been the biggest thing is just staying the course. And it might not be on your timeline that you expect, but everything is, it's all about that war of attrition and persevering. And as long as you're honestly working towards that goal, you'll see the end result. Stay realistic, but you know, you can also keep an unrealistic mindset as well. There's so many stories in sports, and this is why I love sports. There's so many stories in sports of like guys who stayed with it. Like there was that, one of the big inspirations for me was that guy who had played in the G League and then he got signed up to the Lakers.
Andre Ingram.
Yeah. And he like just went on this unbelievable tear and, you know, fulfilled that dream. But he had gone years and years and years in the G League making minimum. And then they bring him up and he just absolutely dazzled in his start with the Lakers. And so like stuff like that was always inspirational to me. And as I got older and as I got closer to that cutoff where I knew the UFC wasn't going to sign me, you know, I still stayed faithful and I was like, okay, I still stay on the course. And it could be easy to say like, oh, you're not going to make it, or, oh, you know, but I just kept staying on the course and I was like, all right, I can do this. Like I can still make it. And, yeah, just don't let the discouragement creep in, like kick it out. I can't tell you how many times I've told myself this, President Updorf's talk, doubt your doubts. I would always doubt my doubts. I still push that out of my, you know, when I think like, oh, this guy's going to beat me. I'm like, no, he's not going to beat me. You know, like I've got to doubt the doubt that creeps in.
Well, your story is unbelievable, and I appreciate you being willing to share it with me and with those listening to the podcast. Congratulations on all of your accomplishments so far, and good luck with what's next. We hope that you can get that next fight, get the win, and keep plugging along, because what a great example you are as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as a BYU alum, a great example. And could not be more proud. So thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate you guys having me on. It's been awesome.
You can download and subscribe to all Deep Blue podcasts on all podcast platforms. Find all episodes on the BYU Radio app. My name is Jason Shepherd. Ben Hall produced this episode. Deep Blue senior producer is Cleon Wall. Deep Blue is a production of BYU Radio.